This is Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istril and Darknotch. We'd like to thank Fantasy Flight Games for our hobby and their continued support, Drew Dallas at Card Game DB for our hosting, and the AGOT community as a whole for making this possible. Let us take you beyond the wall.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we're going to have a quick introduction, after which we're going to talk about the overview of Worlds, and then the huge announcements for Thrones that happened at Worlds, and finally some closing remarks.
Welcome to episode 41 of Beyond the Wall. This is a big episode. This is the first of, I think, three episodes we're going to dedicate to Worlds this year, because there was so much to come out of Worlds this year.
Yeah, it was amazing. And, you know, it's the first episode we have two champs on the show, Alex.
Yeah, the number of people that had, the line's getting, a bit tired already, but the number of people that have recommended we change our podcast name to Two Champs, No Chomp, or something in the similar vein. before we jump into Worlds, actually, there were other important tournaments this weekend. I know we'll obviously focus on Worlds, but there was a big tournament in France, in Paris, the Open de Paris, the Tourney of the Hand. I think that was some 40 players, and that was won by Targ Maester's Path.
That's just not exciting to me. You know why? Worlds happened!
Give other tournaments their due. There was the Octagon tournament. That was a very important part of our cast for a good portion of the last couple of months. It was the lead-up to Worlds, was when I ruled out my deck for Worlds. And that was won by a friend of the show, someone who's appeared a couple of times, Helmut, also playing Targ TMT.
I mean, that was pretty cool. That was a bigger tournament, 100-plus people, and Helmut is a top-level player, and to see him win that, you know, he's deserving, so that was great. I agree. I'd probably say the same about the French tournament. I just don't know enough of the French players.
Mm-hmm. That was won by the French tournament, I think, was won by Rwandra, I believe. And the third tournament that I know of was the Betrayal at the Wall, which was in Newcastle. Someone who helped me test my Worlds deck when I was out in the UK and convinced me not to play the shitty deck that I had at the time. I actually did very, very well there. He made the cut, but dropped. But in the end, that was won by a Bear of Black Sails running Val.
Which is a very solid deck. And how many players did they have there?
They had 23, so they had a decent showing as well for a local tournament.
Yep. I wish I could get 23 at all my local tournaments.
I have a sneaking suspicion that in a year or so, that will be very easy.
Well, we got like 20 now, so that's pretty good. So I'm hoping with the reboot we're going to see a big influx.
So let's briefly go over the plan then for our Worlds coverage this year. What do we have planned?
Well, we're going to talk about the announcement tonight. If you've been living under a rock or something, FFG has decided to do rotation and a reboot of Thrones, after which we're going to talk about the Melee, which was the day after. You may have heard Alex made the final table of that, and I made top 16, so we got a lot to say. And then finally the Joust, where Alex did extremely well and went 9-1, I think.
9-1, I lost in the second or third round of the cut.
And I just missed the cut at 35.
Well, maybe, yeah, so I think we'll do those as separate episodes and hopefully get the most relevant guests. I've actually already talked to the Melee champion, and he's agreed to come on the show and come talk to us about the Melee day, so we'll do that one next week, and hopefully we can line up Sam as well for the Joust episode, which will happen the day after Stalic. I do want to briefly go over sort of Worlds overall, though, because, you know, aside from the rotation announcement, which we'll be talking about a lot, I mean, that was a phenomenal tournament. It was smoothly run. It was record attendance. It was really a blast. And I got to see a lot of people, a lot of fans of the show.
We had some worries about attendance, actually. There was a point at the very beginning where people were saying there's a waiting list and people may not actually get in to play the Joust or Melee, because FFG had sent out a survey to people and said, which games are you going to play? And a lot of people just didn't fill it out. So they didn't expect that many Thrones players. So it was kind of a last-minute rejig they had to do to make sure they had enough space within the fire regulations that everyone could play.
They did manage it, though. I know they said they had been telling people that if they hadn't pre-registered and hadn't filled out the survey, they were sending out emails recommending that people don't come because they weren't going to be able to fit them in. In the end, everybody on the waiting list for Melee and everybody on the waiting list for Joust got into the tournament. And for Melee, we had 104 players. For Joust, we had 141. So for both of those categories, that makes it the largest ever tournament on North American soil, which is exactly what you want from this game.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people on the waiting list were some really well-known names, though. I mean, Greg Atkinson was on the waiting list for Joust. Peter Wilson was on the waiting list for Joust. Aaron Glazer was on the waiting list for Joust. It would have been tragic not to see these top-level players participate.
Well, it's tragic for anyone. If you flew in, even if it's your first tournament and so on, how horrible is it that you couldn't get into your premier event? So I'm very, very glad they made that. I guess while we're on the hiccups, though, there was one other hiccup, which has it's not the first time this has happened. When they posted the Melee cut, they apparently had made a scoring error or someone had reported something wrong. So they posted the Melee cut, and then Brooks Mitchell, who we still owe an appearance on this cast and an interview with Nate French because of his conquest win earlier in the season, was placed at 16th. And then when they revised it, he was placed at 17th, dropping out of the cut.
You mean 33rd?
No, this is Melee.
Oh, Melee, I'm sorry, Eric.
Yeah, for Melee. Yeah. And luckily, they'd actually printed off a 17th Melee playmat, so they were able to give him that. We were able to give him a few of our alt art cards as well. I mean, it really sucks to be told you made the cut and then told you haven't. But speaking of our alt art cards, tell us a little bit about how that went.
They were sought after. People really liked the alt art cards, so we gave out almost all of them. A few are going to Shalik with Sandy. They, of course, are the leftovers, so they aren't the premium picks, which seem to be Fear Winter, Shadow Black Lane, and Aftermath. Those were the big ones that people were really looking for, from my perspective.
We wound up handing out quite a lot of them. We've both done very well in the Melee, and we're giving them out to everyone we beat. We both beat more people than we lost to in Joust, so, you know.
Yep. And then there was this overall problem. You getting overall, people were convinced that you beat everyone demanded alternate art cards.
Yeah, that was Alex Esposito, and that's a stroke of brilliance. You know, he hadn't got a chance to get the cards, and I just won overall, and then he comes up and says, you know, technically, since you won overall, you beat everybody, so you owe us all a card. So just for bringing that up, of course, I gave him a card. I thought that was a spot on.
The beginning of the end for us, because everyone quickly heard of this. Yeah, and it was great. I mean, you can actually look in the semifinal game with some of the people playing with the alt art cards, specifically Aftermath. I know some people on the stream was like, what card is that? That's an alt art Beyond the Wall card is what that is.
If only they could also see the card back with the Beyond the Wall logo. That'd be perfect advertising.
But while we're talking about the alt art cards, I encourage everyone to take a look at the bottom of those cards and see the artist's names to the art you like and shoot on to DeviantArt and take a look at their art and, you know, maybe spend a few bucks, you know, buying some of their artwork. And if you really like specific pieces of the Beyond the Wall art and you want to donate to that artist, I would be happy to print out some more and send them to you so that those artists can get their due, because they were really kind in, you know, letting us use their art for a non-profit thing like this.
So while we're on the subject of sort of alternate art cards and swag and things like that, there were a number of other people bringing, you know, their local goods. I mean, Seth Booth had made a whole bunch of wooden power tokens of
gorgeous
house cards that were fantastic that he was selling or trading. I think Aoria had brought a couple of sets of the Batalla por el Muro 2012 house cards, which are among my favorite ever. You know, Kevin Shee was handing out Valar d'Ojeras, Valar Morghulis coins that he had. It was just, you know, people were bringing what their local communities have made, that kind of stuff, and sharing it with everybody else. And that was maybe a really good way to embody Worlds.
Yeah, and, you know, and I really like the fact that FFG kind of did their own thing where they gave us three of these gold or power counters, whatever you want to do, that were targ, and you could play and bet on side matches to accumulate more of them or trade for other things. And I think that added a cool twist to the tournament.
Yeah, I heard that there were actually people that, rather than betting them on their own matches were betting them on other people's matches. You know, after they'd finished their match, they'd go find a game that they thought was really close, and then they'd bet a Targ token on the match. And
yeah, I got the opportunity to play Greg Atkinson, actually, and two people were betting on our match when we played. So that was it was interesting to see that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if we were to do props and slops, which we won't, and we were to thank people that we'd seen at Worlds, it would go on forever. We had tons of people come out to talk to us, tons of people reach out to us. People were buying drinks. People were buying food for everyone that was out drinking. People were just generally it was a community mingling, and I mean, it's fantastic.
Someone showed up with 2 2-4s of beer and, like, 15 bottles of alcohol where we were, and then someone else bought everyone pizza. I think it was Aaron that bought the pizza. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's pretty fantastic when the community is doing that kind of stuff. And I know that a bunch of guys went out to the clubs afterwards, maybe the younger crowd, and that was covered by a couple of prominent members of the community.
If I had one regret for Worlds, it's that, and this is a first world problem, I know, people will just mock me for it, but, you know, having played in the Melee and all the way to the Cut and the Final Table and the Joust and the Cut and all that time, I wind up having less time than expected to interact with the community some more. And if I were going to do it again, I would actually add a day, show up a day early and play some casual matches or stick around for the Sunday. You know, it really was a timing thing that I could not afford to do that now with the newborn and so on. But I'd add a day to Worlds for me, even if there weren't any specific events for the day.
Yeah, I agree. Leaving super early on Sunday was a little tough, so we couldn't quite party with everyone. We had to rest a little bit, which didn't quite work out.
Yeah, that's maybe a story that we can share another time.
Yes, it was special.
All right. Anything else you want to add, then, John?
No, I mean, I had a great time. I was a little sick, and I apologize for anyone that may have caught whatever I was toting around, but I was no less sick than Steve Simone, who seemed to be dying as well, so I didn't feel that bad. I had a comrade in sickness, I guess.
Comrade in sickness. Hey, if the last, if two out of the last three overall champions are sick, surely that gives me better odds, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was happy. I had the same performance as John Bruno and Greg Atkinson and the I'm happy if I can do what John Bruno does.
I should mention that, of course, we will be getting the full stats for the Annals. It's just a question of FFG taking some well-deserved time off before they can do the extra work of giving me those stats.
So we were talking earlier about little hiccups that happened. I don't know if a lot of people know, but there was a hiccup with the Joust, in my opinion, as well. Corey decided to drop, which is completely legitimate. Yeah, he's not a player that likes to play in tournaments after the cut because he finds they're too competitive. He really just enjoys building decks and having fun in the game, which I can respect. However, another player who had decided that he was actually going to be playing in another tournament the day before played his match and then threw it at the end instead of just dropping and allowing the next person on the list to kind of play a game that would actually advance them to the title, because I believe the person that did this actually won their game and then decided to drop before hitting the 15-yard. Like, set his challenge, would have won, said, okay, I drop now. I don't know. That, to me, was like, if you weren't going to play the next day, just drop and let the person that wanted to play, play. So, that was the only other thing I saw at the tournament.
Yeah, I can certainly see how the 33rd, or the person who wound up 33rd after Corey's drop, would take that to heart. I guess the very last thing I'd like to say, we did our very best to keep our fans and everyone else updated through our Facebook page. If you weren't following us and you weren't tracking our Facebook page, there are some photos that I took there of the events, of the prize support, of the ridiculous amount of swag I got to take home, but also of the top cuts and the pairings and some information live that we could get. So if you want to go back and have a look at that and see a little bit what the event center looked like, what the banners for the new Game of Thrones 2.0 looked like,
I'm so
check
excited.
Out our Facebook page. Oh, so am I. But we'll talk about in the next segment.
That's going to be so good. I'm sorry. I'm keen.
So we're joined today, given that we weren't actually able to attend the State of the LCG announcement, by someone who was, by Vapad, who has previously been on the show three times now, I think.
I think so. Hello again.
You've also been and you've recently been on the other podcast, too.
I have.
Whoa, you went on the other podcast?
I did. You don't listen to their other podcasts?
Well, I'm just kind of sad that you took the time to build a deck with us and test with us for Worlds, like both Amelia and Joe's deck, and you went on the other podcast.
All I did with them was build fake decks. I helped go over the Targ deck in his reboot.
Right, so it's like a Targ deck that you didn't actually play.
That doesn't actually exist for cards that are no longer going to exist at all.
Okay, I feel all right then.
Basically, we wasted a lot of time.
As long as Arpakos is like your real girlfriend, and that was the one you like gave the fake number to.
There you go, something like that.
All right. So you were actually at the State of the LCG announcement. So maybe you
at the
can
skin of my teeth.
Maybe you can walk us through it, not just for the Thrones reboot, but how it was received and among the other LCG communities as well.
I tell you, it was really exciting to be there, and it was really interesting, kind of watching the presentation unfold. They started off, it almost seems like a marketing pitch in a way, or maybe like kind of like a shareholders type presentation where they showed off how successful the LCG product line has been. They talked about the transition with Thrones being the guinea pig back in 2008, followed shortly thereafter by Cthulhu, and about how since then, their revenue on the game has grown by 2,000%, which is an impressive number. And then once they kind of expressed to us how well the games were doing, they talked about the need to adapt the games for a longer lifespan. They talked about their vision for rotation in general, the model they were going to use with the core plus whatever deluxe expansions plus 5 to 7 cycles, and the way that once the beginning of the 8th cycle came out, 2 would drop off, so you'd only ever have this card pool that kind of maxed out about 1,500 cards. And as a Thrones fan, I'm kind of watching them go game by game. Each one that they're doing is not Thrones. They're talking about Conquest and Star Wars and Cthulhu, and they're talking about how they're gonna, when the rotation will hit for that and what it will look like. And kind of, I'm turning to Dan, and we're both saying this isn't gonna work. This isn't gonna be good. And then they get to Thrones and they say, well, Thrones is kind of too broken for this. And they put up this beautiful slide that's a picture of Jaime Lannister that says the things we do for love. And that's when they dropped the second edition bombshell.
We kind of lived through the exact same building of tension.
I was taking photographs of each slide and texting them to you, so I hope
that's
so.
That's right, exactly. So we're there.
There was one photo that threw us off.
In the airport, we did the same thing. We were flicking through the slides, and we saw these rotation ones. And essentially, our conclusion was that they said, we're keeping the core and the deluxe. And I said, well, then Thrones is pretty much in trouble.
Yeah.
And I turned off my tablet, and we went over to our gate. And I said, well, I'll fire it up again and see if there's anything else. And then there's that slide that says, but this is not enough for Thrones.
So you were standing in that room, Dave. What was the general feel? Like, were people all like, oh, no, when they said this, when they started talking Thrones? Because I know a lot of Thrones players were there.
It really was met with a very warm reception. It was kind of exciting to be there. There was a lot of applause. I think the overwhelming sentiment in the room was one of incredible excitement and a positive outlook. And I know that some of the presenters afterwards, in chatting with them, said, you know, we were really nervous about that moment because we didn't know if it was going to be excitement or mass revolution or quiet shock or angered shock. And I think FFG certainly got the reaction that they were hoping for as well. I mean, maybe I talked to the wrong people, but I didn't see anyone in the room who was about to go burn all of his cards. I think that the people who were there, the people who are kind of the most heavily invested in this game are probably the people who were there. And those are the people who recognize that the game has grown beyond what it can support in terms of rules, band-aids, and fixes that are not permanent solutions, and, you know, really want to see the game succeed long-term. And that's what it seems like second edition is trying to do. And from all appearances right now, it seems like it's going to do a good job of it.
I know that when we saw the announcement, John, and I was with John and Sean, and there were sort of three reactions. I was immediately elated. John was wary for about 5 minutes, thinking it through, and then sort of got excited about it. What was going through your head at the time, John?
Well, I mean, it was a pretty big shock, right? And after the first shock of, we're going to do rotation, and I kept thinking to myself, oh my God, the Martell box set's broken, the Greyjoy box set sucks. We're going to have these two extremes in the pool. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's not enough. And then they announce this new concept, and they throw all these tidbits of rules at you, right? There's not going to be a draw cap. We're going to have this way of stopping cards sometimes in the taxation phase. And I thought, well, that's broken. I thought of all the negative things. And then about 5 minutes later, I thought, well, that assumes that all the way things work now is how they're going to do it again. And I realized that's probably not the case. They're probably smart enough to realize the same thing I did in 5 seconds and said, you know, we're not going to put draw in the marshalling before the marshalling phase. We'll do it in the challenge phase. And I thought to myself, oh my God, if that's in the challenge phase, that's so much more cool because now there's even more challenge stuff, more interactions that I realized.
You make a lot of,
could be really great.
We make a lot of assumptions that we're going to have to rethink in terms of how even stuff like that. Exactly. When is the draw phase? Maybe the draw phase is after the challenges phase. Who knows?
Yeah. And then, the more I thought about it, the more I thought this could be a really great thing for a game. Because I always knew that something had to be done. It's just the huge change, like all changes, felt negative at first. And Sean had a much more negative reaction. But we have to realize that he is an extremely new player. He's just started the game within the last 3 to 5 months. And he just finished buying all the cards. And in his mind, all this talk was rotation, not a reboot. So he was buying all the newer stuff first in order to make sure that he be ready for a rotation, and he was just kind of like, oh, well, I just wasted, you know, $700, and that really sucks. Love the game. The reason I bought all these cards is because I really think it's an awesome game. I haven't got the chance to explore all the stuff that maybe older players like myself and you, Alex, and Dave, and of course you, Vapad, have got. And to have that kind of taken away from him, I think gave him a big blow, and he was just like, oh. And he was pretty upset about it for the whole plane right there, and I think he slowly changed to, well, you know, it can't be that bad. It's going to be cool to have a new game, and it's not like I don't get to play with these cards. I had a good time. There's going to be a year left. I'm still going to get tournaments out of them. And then I think by the time we left Worlds, he was thinking positively of it, and I hope that's the transition that everyone that had a negative reaction goes through, maybe not as fast, because he was, you know, surrounded by a bunch of people that saw it in a very positive light and kind of gave their point of view, and he could see the merit in it, which I think drove him towards, you know, happiness.
we even saw a little bit of that in our meta, just kind of virtually. I looked at our Facebook group right as the announcement went up, and I saw some posts, some from newer players like that who were kind of in a similar position to Sean. And the first post was, "Oh no, like oh crap, I guess I'm out." And then I started to post, and some other players started to post. Or, hang on, guys. This is a good thing. And we started talking about why. You know, I don't know that everyone's come around yet. Certainly I'm going to see more people this week at our weekly meetup. But I think that there has been a similar kind of shift, and I hope that by the end of it, everyone will see it in that positive light. And I think you're right that the more time people spend digesting this and people spend kind of talking through it and thinking through it with some more experienced players, I think the more they will come around, because, you know, the game is in a place where it really did need an overhaul, and that they can take the good parts that make it what it is, that make it the outstanding game that we love, and clean up and replace all the bad parts that have kind of weighed it down and have stopped new players from really immersing themselves in it in an easy manner.
All right. Well, for those of our listeners who have been living under a rock and have not actually seen this, the slides were posted on, for instance, Dennis's Twitter feed. That was at FFG Worlds, so you can have a look at the slides themselves. FFG themselves have since posted an article for each game explaining how rotation will work in that game. And they put up a very nice letter from Nate French, an open letter from Nate French called The Things We Do for Love, in which they go over, I assume, most of the same content. I do want to mention that letter, though. I think it hits very much the right tone, especially in comparison to that Spaniard letter from Christian Peterson announcing the LCG, which had a tone that was very difficult to get around, even though his arguments were quite cogent.
I think that's right. I think the letter from Nate was honestly even a little more illuminating than the presentation. There was some more information in it. And, you know, I think it's possible to polish a written product often to a finer point than you can an oral presentation. presentation. I thought the letter was extremely comprehensive, and reading the letter after seeing the presentation made me even more excited.
Yeah, there was the letter. There's the product page, which is now up. There were also three sets of interviews with Team Covenant and people within the company, at least touching on the announcement. So there is a fair bit of content to go through.
Yes.
Now, I mean, this was, to me, it was the perfect solution, but it was the solution that I did not expect them to have, to put it bluntly, the guts to pull the trigger.
100% agree.
And, you know, they mentioned the same thing in many of these interviews. They said, you know, we could have done the easy thing. Thrones is at its highest attendance. It is its highest playability. It's thriving as better than it ever has. You know, we could sit on that for about 3 years. It would start to choke itself out and disappear. And, you know, so they actually thought that, and they said, look, we can take advantage of that right now. Probably the fact that there may well be a book in a year, probably the fact that there are, you know, all these other things. Well, not a year, 2 years, a book in 2 years.
Here's hoping.
But maybe let's start with the bad stuff, because obviously I love this. I am elated. I will continue to be elated. I love to talk about it. But there are a few downsides, and one of the first is that we're talking about, you know, right now this living card game still has another cycle coming out that people will be less inclined to buy. When the next set comes out, the card pool will still be fairly small for a period of about a year, so that's actually sort of 2 years until the game sort of hits its real stride again. None of your old cards are usable, so especially people who have come to the game more recently, like John was mentioning, will feel that they've gotten considerably less mileage out of their cards than perhaps veterans do, with good reason.
Sure. I think that the latter concern will be largely eliminated if those people give the core set of the new edition a chance, because I think there's something really exciting about starting a new game at the ground level. You're on a perfectly level playing field with everyone else. You don't have this barrier of knowledge where you're still trying to figure out. You see a card played, and I didn't know that a card existed. If you didn't know it existed, neither did anyone else, because you're all in the same starting point. It was so much fun to get into Star Wars at that point about a year ago. I've since gotten out of Star Wars, but it was so much fun to have that experience of being among the first people to play it, going to the first national championship.
It's an opportunity for innovation.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no established deck types. We're not going to say, oh, that's just the same old Stark Winter with three cards added, or, oh, that's just, you know, Targ Burn with X. No, there's going to be none of that, because we're going to be establishing those new archetypes over the next year, and that, to me, is cool.
Yes, absolutely.
And it seems, from what I hear, that the game's going to be way more flexible. Like, you're going to have this loyalty mechanic and these ways of allying with different houses, they said. And that sounds like there's going to be just a lot of different combinations of things we can do, even with the core set.
Yeah. So before we talk into sort of what's gone and what's new, there's one last thing I want to touch on, which is that, to me, the greatest advantage of this Switch is the ability to grow the community. And obviously, from a financial perspective for FFG, that's a large portion of what they're thinking. But I love this game, and I love to play it, and I would love to have a meta that I could go down to and have 30 people that we go down to the pub and would play. And that's something that's very, very difficult to get started. Most of the metas that we recognize are metas that have been around since the CCG, especially the big ones, because they had this, and they've maybe gathered a few players since then. But it's getting, you know,
it's difficult
to grow the game. And if you love this game and you love to play it, the fact that we can absolutely increase our player base rapidly will just be the biggest part of this announcement. You'll get to play the game you like. It'll be a similar game, but you'll get to play it with more people.
And I think we really will. I mean, even in the hotel over the weekends, I was talking to some Netrunner players who said, you know, we tried to get into Thrones, and it was just too many cards, and the rules seemed so complicated, and Netrunner was new. Netrunner was simple. It was much easier to get into. But we like the books. We like the TV show. If there's a new game, we're going to give the new game a shot. And I hope that is representative of, you know, kind of the community of gamers who like this type of game.
So maybe what we should do next then is talk about what's going to be different. What's going to be the same? What have they told us so far? What information do we have?
Well, the thing that really surprised me was that plots are going to be different in general because there's going to be a new value on them, and your hand size is actually going to be determined by your plot. And I think that's a pretty big change because at the same time, they're going to be removing the draw cap.
This is what they're calling the reserve value. And they have given us one example of it so far. They've given us the stats on Wildfire Salt, which is going to be a 4-3-1, where you get to pick two characters that survive, and it has a reserve value of, I think it was 4?
That's so hard to evaluate in the vacuum. The way that I understand the reserve value, and you guys can tell me if you understood it differently, was it basically is a check in the taxation phase that you must discard down to that number of cards?
Yeah.
Correct.
It is not like the Star Wars reserve where you adjust your hand to that number of cards. So if, say, you had one card, you would draw 3. That's how it works in Star Wars, and my understanding is that is not how it works in Thrones 2.0.
That's my understanding as well. You discard down to your reserve value. If you only have one card left, then you stay at the one
stay
card.
Stay at the one. In theory, I mean, I think it's a great idea. I think it's a potentially elegant way to do away with a draw cap, so long as there is not kind of an overblown opportunity to draw and then use cards before you get to that taxation phase. Because I guess it's meaningless if you can draw 8 cards in the challenge phase and they're all events and you can play all 8 events in the challenge phase and then the reserve doesn't mean much.
It is kind of cool because you have to stack your deck with events, which, setup isn't gone. So I would assume that events still have trouble being set up.
Probably. But there may also be, I mean, we're still making more assumptions that there may be ways to play different cards outside of, I mean, is there even going to be a marshalling phase? I assume there will be a marshalling phase. But there may be more different ways to play cards maybe that even aren't events. As long as that reserve check is meaningful, that you can't use all the resources that you gain because of this check, then it's going to be a good thing.
Or you'll build your deck so that you don't generate extra resources that you're discarding.
Right.
There are a lot of assumptions that we're making coming from Thrones 1.0. I mean, for instance, if there is recursion like there is in Thrones 1.0, then a reserve value becomes almost meaningless.
Sure.
So they'll certainly have to take that into account, but I mean, I'm sure they will. What's the stuff that's disappearing? They listed a couple of things that they were going to get.
Moribund. Moribund State is disappearing. Alex, you want to talk about that first?
I think there might be a problem with a game where the three best-known rules lawyers are the designer, an actual lawyer, and a PhD. And those, I mean, you should be able to understand the rules from a faster read-through. And I strongly suspect in this and in many other things, you're going to see the templating that we see in, for instance, Conquest, that we've seen in Star Wars. They're going to use the interrupt framework for anything that would have had to happen in a Moribund state. So it's going to interrupt the process of something dying in order to either save or cancel or to trigger something because it died. There's going to be responses or reactions, and then instead of passives, I imagine they're going to go to forced reactions.
I think that's right. It would be action, reaction, interrupt, and then perhaps a forced reaction if it's something that has to happen.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's said they were going to get rid of some keywords, but they'll probably be keeping keywords, which are basically a shorthand version of forced reactions normally.
Yep.
So I think that will greatly simplify the timing structure. I mean, no one thinks Moribund is a good idea.
I don't think so.
Even I don't think Moribund's a good idea, and I'm not a rules guy, so that's it. It's done.
All right.
It's truth.
I didn't actually know that Moribund wasn't in the original game. Apparently, it was added a couple of years into the game to fix broken things.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it was.
You know, I had a quick chat with K-Tom at Worlds, and he said, you know, the stuff they're talking about here just makes me feel like we're taking all the best from the CCG and all the best from the LCG, combining them together to make the best game ever. And I said, wow, I'm so glad you said that because that sounds so cool.
Other things that they specifically said that they were going to get rid of were crests, which they called glorified traits. I can certainly see that. There's no reason Power of Blood can't be lords and ladies cannot be killed. You know, it would be functionally the same for the vast majority of this and possibly more usable. Except for the Shadows Crest, they mentioned that the Shadows mechanic, I think, would stick around.
I think so.
They also said that they would get rid of influence, which is something that
they
I've been a fan of. Ugh. I suspect you, Dave, are slightly less of a fan. I know that in your 2C1C episode, which I did listen to, you specifically mentioned that I am a big fan of getting rid of influence, and you are not.
I do like influence. I do like having – I do think there's a certain challenge to balancing a second resource curve and a payoff that can come from it. But certainly it's not a necessary part of the game. I caught up with Eric Lang after the discussion. I said, look, you know, I'm a Targ player. Don't take my influence. I like my tricks. And he said, if you like playing Targ in first edition, you'll love it even more in second edition. So that made me happy.
It sounds like they might have, you know, a gold cost to some events or something. It would be my gut feel on that.
It could be. It could be that. It could be more things like Khal Drogo, where, you know, you still have kind of ambush effects or maybe burn effects, but that trigger off of game events rather than costs that you have to pay with a resource.
Bit of a, if the bouncing cow still exists, reserve values are going to make him very interesting.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some things that you hope are gone that they haven't mentioned?
Put me on the spot. Hope are gone that they haven't mentioned necessarily are going. I kind of hope they do away with taxation. I've never liked taxation in the sense of having to give back all your gold. I like the idea of being able to save and store, and especially if there are things like Zolo in the environment that make that risky. I've always thought it was kind of odd that if you don't spend that kind of resource, it evaporates entirely.
But don't you think, I mean, if there is a dominance phase and it's still based on gold, letting gold carry from turn to turn will sort of snowball away the importance of a dominance phase.
Sure, but the easy answer there is just don't make gold have any impact on dominance. I'm not even sure we need a dominance phase. A dominance phase is another thing I wouldn't mind seeing go. I do think it's kind of an awkward thing and something that new players are often, I found, confused by.
Epic phases. I want to see epic phases be like every other phase in the game. The fact
I'm
that
not
there's
sure I
no
want to see them at all.
I'm not sure I want to see epic phases.
Action, yeah. So, I mean, that's what I mean. I think epic phases could go, I'd be happy.
I do think the taxation thing is unlikely because they specifically mentioned
they did say there would
that
be
the
a
reserve
taxation
value would kick in taxation.
But it could be different. The taxation phase could say in the taxation phase every player places one gold from his pool back into the treasury if able.
Able. So, yeah, I suppose. One thing that comes up for me, plot rotation. I think we've recognized in the game in the last year that people, or at least people like me, don't like plot rotation. and generally most plot manipulation. The plot mechanic is one of the ones they said was integral to the game, core to the game, and that they didn't want to get rid of it. And to me, that is also a sort of admission that we want it to remain as central to the game, and we don't want you to regularly be picking your plots after your opponent or before your opponent or getting a chance to change your plots. So I hope we see very little or none at all of plot rotation.
I think they learned their lesson with that one. I mean, they basically restricted wheels before it saw the light of day. They restricted a lot of plot rotation stuff kind of all at once, when those, particularly Martell, but also some of those Starker Barry decks proved to be problematic. And I don't think they want it. I think they know that's problematic.
What else do I have? I have on my list of things that I'd like to see gone, most recursion. And I don't really mean that as all recursion, but I mean that if a house has recursion, it should really only be for one card type under some circumstances. You know, I'm okay with Targ recycling attachments and getting that sort of fuel, but I'm not okay with cards going, oh, well, you know, I discarded it from his hand, but it won't matter ever because he'll just get it back.
I don't mind that so much if that house can't draw. I mean, I think card advantage is important, will remain important, and I don't mind at all different houses having different types of card advantage, but if there's a house that can recur to the level that Barra can now, that house better have significant inabilities to draw cards.
And the last thing that I had on my list of things that I hope are we don't see a lot of is aggressive trait manipulation. Mm-hmm. I don't mind boosting your own characters, you know, turning your own character into a dragon so that it keys off your own synergies, but I don't really like turning someone else into an ally or turning someone else into a refugee. And that's entirely a personal thing. Obviously, it's a mechanic within the game, and some people enjoy it and some people don't. I just happen to be in the camp of people that don't.
Yeah, I mean, I hope there's less permanent removal other than the plots. Obviously, I think Thalmagulas and Wildfire and stuff like that have to be there. But I don't like being able to permanently shut down some characters. I really love the idea of, like, Lannister Neil, icon manipulation for Martell, etc., because it gives the opponent a chance to come back at some point. And I like a game where a player's skill matters more than getting lucky removal cards drawn earlier at the right key moments.
All right, so do we want to talk about what we know is going to be new in the game? So we mentioned the reserve value. But they have actually listed a bunch of other stuff. For instance, you can have two of any one plot in your deck, and only of any one, so you're still going to have at least six different plots in your deck. How do you guys feel about that?
And with certain limits.
And with certain limits. So with Valor limits. Might still be limit one per deck. And
Really wanted to double Valor people.
That was the example they used. Valor Margulis will say limit one per deck.
How do you guys feel about that?
I like it. I think that it adds some new dynamic interaction where if you see me flip my threat, you can't say, okay, he's burned his threat, because maybe I have another one, or any plot like that, where, you know, now you get that kind of thing with Power of Blood, Power of Faith, Power of Arms. You know they can have two, so you see one, and you have to say, okay, maybe there's another one coming. How much more interesting is that when it's any plot that's in their plot deck that seems to be working off the themes that their deck is playing? It keeps you guessing in a new way. But of course, it's not unlimited, because once you see that single double, then you know you don't have to worry about it again.
I've heard some people complain about this because they think, oh, you know, people just run in the current game, you just run two retaliations and things like that. I don't think that's necessarily true. I mean, I'm thinking about the decks that I've played recently, and most of them, I want seven different plots.
Yep.
Or I want an opener, a closer, a reset.
And toolboxes.
And some toolboxes. Now, some decks are different. If you know, you really need the high claim and so on. But I think that another advantage of this is that when we get a small card pool, being able to double up on a plot will actually increase your options tremendously.
I was about to say, I think doubling up on plots will make the game so much more dynamic. Already, the plot guessing game is a key component, but now with that extra change that you might have the second plot, I think it'll add to the game a lot when the card pool is smaller. So I think it was a good call from FSG.
It's going to be fun.
One of the biggest things that people are talking about right now is the fact that they said they were going to add additional factions. And in fact, I think the 2C1C people posted a picture having noticed that the banners had a border that had all these house sigils, so they posted a picture of that, and we can see the six ones we recognize, but we can also clearly see the Rose of Highgarden and something that looks oddly, I would have expected Aaron, even though I would have probably disagreed with it, it looks oddly like a bird with a sword, and is probably something related to the Night's Watch.
That's what I thought it did look like a crescent moon, but I didn't examine it closely. Other people have said they thought it looked like the steward symbol, the sword and the raven.
So they did say they were adding the factions, and they said they will be redoing the color pie accordingly and focusing in on the themes that the factions were supposed to have. A particularly good quote of Nate's in an interview with Team Covenant was that, you know, he had gone back to the books and reread them and tried to forget everything he knew about the Game of Thrones game and draw out all the possible themes that a house could have and then try and reassign those. And he said that basically there were some themes that just lined up exactly like they did in Game of Thrones 1.0, but other ones which really belonged to other houses or should never have been in a specific house. And he thinks he can specialize them a little bit more with 8 and clearly identify them. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah.
I mean, you might be a little sad, right, Faithpad, because you're going to have to change your whole wardrobe depending on the color Targaryen gets now.
They can't change the color, can they?
Targ's going to go black.
They're going to go black? They're a black field with a red symbol. Do you think they would go black, right, not red?
I'd be sad if they went black.
You'd be sad if they went black, but red is Crimson is Lannister's colors.
Yep. Lannister can have gold.
No, Barra needs gold.
Barra can have green.
Why would Barra be green?
I don't know.
Yeah, what's the logic with that?
High Garden would be green.
Ah, we're getting screwed here. All right. All right.
Start buying your black clothes now.
Damn.
This is all speculation, obviously. They make the colors just for the legacy colors. But it's worth noting that in the original CCG, Stark was purple.
Not, really?
Yeah.
Okay. I did not know that.
You should look up one of their cards on AGOT cards from the...
Oh, and the old CCG cards, you're talking about the borders, right? I've seen, like, yeah, it's like a Northern Keeps and things like that, yeah.
There's another thing that they mentioned, which was the system of loyalty and the system of treaties. They mentioned that treaties are not particularly... They never quite hit the spot in Game of Thrones. Conquest was probably the closest we ever got to more free-flowing treaty agenda. And that, as I understand it, and the wording's not quite clear, instead of running an agenda, you can choose to ally with another house. And if you do, you can play everything in that house that isn't loyal to that house, which is basically a new way of saying House X only. So
that's
it looks like it's replacing your agenda, which is an interesting way of doing it. I guess it's functionally an agenda in that case. But
right.
I really wonder, because I don't like the idea of there being Barra and Targ together. I don't like the idea of there being Adrian Martell
Stark
and Lanny. So I hope there's, like, except that it's harder for, say, Highgarden and Arryn to have a house that they would never ally with, for it to all balance out. But I hope there's some sort of restriction.
It's possible if there truly is a color pie that perhaps you can only ally with other houses that are proximate to you in whatever pie exists. I don't know if that's something they're exploring or if they really will make it a free-for-all.
Mm-hmm.
And did you get a sense in terms of the loyalty? Can you pay just with no gold penalty, anyone from your allied house that's not loyal, or will there be some sort of loyalty point value where there's an adjusted gold value based on the card's power level or the card's type?
Well, it seems like they were implying they didn't like the gold penalty in Game of Thrones 1.0. But I don't know whether they said anything else. I mean, you were at the presentation, but the text I've seen so far, it's just,
yeah.
It apparently they'd never liked the gold penalty, or they haven't liked the gold penalty as a means of enforcing houses playing within your house. And so they're looking for some other way, which in this case is the treaty agendas. I'm guessing you can't play out of house cards at all unless you don't have an agenda. And if you do, you can choose a house that you can ally to.
I think I like that. I've never the Nedley player in me has always found out of house stuff kind of odd. I've never liked uniques out of house. I wouldn't mind if all uniques were loyal.
Mm-hmm. Other new stuff they mention, and this is in the product description, not really in any of the announcements, that the core set will be for up to 6 players rather than for up to 4. They're keeping melee, which I'm actually quite happy about.
It's going to be melee is going to be more than 4 players supposedly. That's crazy.
Wow.
The default format may still be 4 players. Who knows? But at least the core box says up to 6, which may just be because it'll have decks for all 8 factions rather than just for 4 like the original core set. That might be why they're saying up to 6, because it's easier to do that. The core set itself, we know it will require 5 sleeve packs, so that it'll have no more than 250 cards. It'll be $40. I mean, most of that allows us to compare it to Conquest, which had a little over 200 player cards, but also had 40 tokens and 10 planet cards and stuff like that. That would be slightly different in our case.
So 250 cards. So
that's the maximum.
If there are all 8 factions, call it 240. Is that only, help me out with my math here, is that 30 cards a faction?
It's 30 cards a faction, yeah.
That's not very many.
It's not.
Well, I mean, that was similar to what we had in the original core, right?
We had 45 cards per house in the original
core.
But
there was doubles in a bunch of the cards.
Plus plots.
There were doubles of a couple, and then, yes, 45 was the draw deck. So, yeah. I mean, that is significantly fewer cards if, in fact, all 8 are in the core box, which we don't know.
I believe they did say all 8 are in the core
box. Did they? Okay.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily worry me. I mean, the deck size is maybe smaller as well. A lot of their games have gone to 50-card decks or smaller, so that may change a couple of ways we look at the size of the card pool. And, you know, I strongly suspect it'll be entirely one-ofs, which means that you'll just buy three.
Three of them.
But
assuming that three is a playset.
Assuming that three is a playset. You're right. It is dangerous to make all these specific assumptions. I mean, I guess really what I'm doing here is comparing to Conquest in a number of reasons, because Conquest had seven factions, so they expanded the number of factions they've done. That Conquest was their most recent LCG launch. It was also the single most successful product launch they've ever had. Apparently, sales were through the roof. Pre-orders were through the roof. It sold out like crazy. It's been ridiculously popular. And that's a good model to follow. Because
sure.
It didn't have an existing player base, not within the LCG base. Thrones 2.0 does and cannot help but be bigger than Conquest was at launch.
Gen Con can't come fast enough.
Gen Con can't come fast enough. And it's also, you know, they've been talking about new tourney software, new judge programs that are going to get piloted next year. By the time Thrones hits its stride in organized play, all of those programs will be at maturity. I think this will be the flagship game. I think this will go back to being FFG's biggest LCG.
I certainly hope so.
Yeah. Oh, man, I hope.
Self-interested.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember one more thing I wanted to mention. We've seen lots of the card art, which looks absolutely phenomenal for Thrones 2.0. The art that they've chosen to include in the articles has been a couple of the really nice ones from the LCG, but also all the new ones have been beautiful. But a lot of people have been talking about the card templating and hoping that it's full bleeds. And I actually am on the other side of that. I really hope they're not full bleed art.
Really? Why
yeah.
is that?
Well, partly because I think that you want a nice, clean templating where, you know, to me, the full bleeds is fine for these alt art cards, the cards that you already know what they do. But I think the templating with the box, which the thing specifically in its place, helps a lot, where you can easily identify the card type straight from looking at the card. I think that's important for these base games. I've been praising Conquest so much, but actually the templating on Conquest is one of the worst, not for how cards are worded, but how they're laid out. Because to me, the differences between the factions are too large. You have these ovals all over the Eldar cards and these harsh symbols all over the other. The locations have the text going from bottom to top, while you know attachments have it going across. I think there's too much difference between card types like that. I think there's some irritation from there. Well, if you look at Netrunner, between two factions, a similar card type is a different color with a sort of like different pattern under it, but there's no differences in where things are found on the cards. So I think that Netrunner there would be an example of card layout done right, where the cards are subtly different.
But still full bleed. I mean, right, Netrunner and Star Wars 2, and even Lord of the Rings, I think, are all full bleed games now.
Maybe I don't mean the same thing by full bleed that you do.
There are no borders?
Yes.
No borders around the art, but the text box is still separate from all the rest. This is the art goes all the way to the edge. So you mean just not a black border or a white border around it?
That's what I would mean by full bleed.
Okay, you don't necessarily mean that the card art takes the entire card and then the text is overlaid on that.
I see your issue. I got it.
Okay.
I'm with you now.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So then in that case, I agree. I don't think there necessarily needs to be a black or a white border around the edges, but I do think that you shouldn't have art on the entire card. I think there should be clearly distinct areas.
An art area and a game text area.
Yeah, exactly.
I understand.
So I hope that's the case, but obviously we'll see.
I would have to believe that since they've introduced the alt art cards, that they would follow in that format. I suppose they could have second thoughts if it did have a negative impact on the game experience.
And then I guess in closing, I'd like to say that I think it's going to be our job as Thrones 1.0 to make sure this launch is as successful as possible. I think a lot of people will come back to this game. A lot of people that have gone to other LCGs or started in other LCGs and been intimidated by Thrones will consider it. So as we get near the date, I'm going to look about setting up inaugural tournaments, giving away some of the swag I've accumulated for prize supports to really get this kickstarted locally. and I hope lots of other people will follow suit. I think we could really get this off the ground with shockingly good start.
I think so, too. Dan and I and Kyle from New York have already spent a lot of time talking about how we're going to do this transition, what we're going to do leading up to it, what kind of things we're going to do when it launches, how it is we're going to be ready when it launches to really make it the best received that it can be and to grow our community bigger than it's been.
And I guess there's an important question, which is, what do both of you feel you're going to do with Thrones 1.0 until Thrones 2.0 releases?
Until or after?
Until.
I think they're going to have normal updates. They're going to have restricted lists. There's still cards coming out. There's going to be a tournament at Gen Con for a national champion, and there's going to be a world champion still. And there's still going to be card designs tied to that, so I think people are going to play it. I know I'm going to play it. I mean, I'll play it until Gen Con. At Gen Con, I'll try to squeeze in both if I can.
I'm still going to buy cards. I'm still going to want to play with the new cards. I don't think that's going to turn off. It'll turn off some people, but it's not. I don't think it's going to be drastic.
See, I think I would be in the minority when I said that I was also going to buy cards. There's only one more cycle. The OCD in me is not going to let my collection be incomplete chapter packs, so I'm definitely going to buy those. And people, as I was leaving Worlds, were already talking about, you know, Black Friday tournament, regionals next year. Even with knowing that this is sort of the last season of organized play coming up, people were still talking about tournaments. And why not? The game was phenomenal at Worlds. The meta is great. I'm still going to enjoy this game with an eye on 2.0.
Absolutely.
In a year from now, I'm going to take my old cards, I'm going to make them into a draft pack, and something else, you know?
I'll
have a cube.
I'm gonna have so much fun trying to build the best possible draft cube that I'm never gonna have to take apart.
All right, Dave. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And see you at tournaments throughout the year, and then in 2.0 at Gen Con.
You bet.
Well, that about wraps up today's episode. I think we don't have any big upcoming tournaments. I think there might be a tournament in Portugal this weekend. But really, I want us to just go over our plan for the next 2 weeks again.
There is a really big tournament coming up.
That's
Shall
2 weeks
I?
From now, though.
Okay.
Yeah.
True enough.
It's not this weekend. It's the weekend after. But yes, that is a massive tournament. It will be bigger than Worlds.
Yes, by far. However, on one day, Joust, that's going to be tough.
Yeah, the current schedule, I think, is all of the Joust in one day. And that's just, wow, what an endurance contest that'll be.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the best deck will win. I think the person that has the highest endurance wins, like 14 rounds or something.
Well, I mean, they may be playing the best deck, too. That's also possible. But
sure.
It certainly make me reconsider playing something with as many triggers as I did at Worlds.
Yeah.
So, what is our plan for the next 2 weeks, John?
Well, we're going to talk about our Worlds experience, basically. We're going to kind of do it in order. We're going to talk about the Melee tournament, and then finally we're going to talk about the Joust and the overall win for Alex Hines.
All right, so remember that the episode today did not take the place of any future episodes. It's actually the episode that should have aired on Monday the 10th and was just late because, well,
we were at Worlds.
Exactly. And then we'll have an episode on Melee on the 17th and on Joust on the 24th.
After which we're probably going to take a break.
Well, we have to do a Stalic episode, but yeah, we'll do take a break after that.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.